prostrate priests, Shiana began the shuffling, unrhythmic movements of the dance. As she remembered, music grew within her. She unclasped her hands and swung her arms wide. Her feet lifted high in the stately movement. Her body turned, slowly at first, and then more swiftly as the dance ecstasy increased. Her long brown hair whipped around her face. The two priests dared to lift their heads. The strange child was performing the dance. They recognized the movements, the dance of propitiation. She asked Shai-Hulud to forgive his people. She asked God to forgive them. They turned their heads to look at each other and together rocked back onto their knees. There they began clapping in the time-honored effort to distract the dancer. Their hands clapped rhythmically as they chanted the ancient words, "Our fathers ate manna in the desert, in the burning places where whirlwinds came." The priests excluded from their attention all except the child. She was a slender thing, they saw, with stringy muscles, thin arms and legs. Her robe and stillsuit were worn and patched like those of the poorest. Her cheekbones had high planes that drew shadows across her olive skin. Brown eyes, they noted. Reddish sun streaks drew their lines in her hair. There was a water-spare sharpness about her features, the narrow nose and chin, the wide forehead, the wide thin mouth, the long neck. She looked like the Fremen portraits in the Holy of Holies at Dar es Balat. Of course, the child of Shai-Hulud would look thus. She danced well, too. Not the slightest quickly repeatable rhythm entered her movements. There was rhythm, but it was an admirably long beat, at least 100 steps apart. She kept it up while the sun lifted her higher and higher. It was almost noon before she fell exhausted to the sand. The priests stood and looked out into the desert where Shai-Hulud had gone. The stampings of the dance had not summoned him back. They were forgiven. That was how Shiana's new life began. Loudly in their own quarters, and for many days, the senior priests engaged in arguments about her. At last, they brought their disputations and reports to the high priest, Hedli Tuek. They met in the afternoon, within the hall of small convocations, Tuek and six priestly counselors. Murals of Leto II, a human face on the great worm shape, looked down upon them with benevolence. Tuek seated himself on a stone bench that had been recovered from the wind gap Sietch. Muad'Dib himself was reputed to have sat on this bench. One of the legs still bore the carvings of an Atreides hawk. His counselors took lesser, modern benches facing him. The high priest was an imposing figure, silky grey hair combed smoothly to his shoulders. It was a suitable frame for the square face with its wide, thick mouth and heavy chin. Tuek's eyes retained their original clear whites surrounding dark blue pupils. Bushy, untrimmed grey eyebrows shaded his eyes. The counselors were a motley lot, scions of old priestly families, each carried in his heart the belief that matters would move better if he were sitting on Tuek's bench. The scrawny, pinch-faced Styros put himself forward as opposite spokesman.
"She is nothing but a poor desert wife, and she rode Shai-Hulud. That is forbidden, and the punishment is mandatory."
Others spoke up immediately.
"No, no, Styros, you have it wrong. She did not stand on Shai-Hulud's back as the Fremen did. She had no maker hooks," or
Styros tried to shout them down. It was deadlocked. Tuek saw. Three and three with Umfrad, a fat hedonist, as advocate for cautious acceptance.
"She had no way to guide Shai-Hulud's course," Umfrad argued. "We all saw how she came down to the sand, unafraid, and talked to him."
Yes, they all had seen that, either at the moment or in the holophoto that a thoughtful observer had recorded. Desert waif or not, she had confronted Shai-Hulud and conversed with him. And Shai-Hulud had not engulfed her. No, indeed. The worm of God had drawn back at the child's command and had returned to the desert.
"We will test her," Tuek said.
Early the following morning, an ornithopter flown by the two priests who had brought her from the desert conveyed Shiana far out, away from the sight of Keen's populace. The priests took her down to a dune top and planted a meticulous copy of a Fremen thumper in the sand. When the thumper's catch was released, a heavy beating trembled through the desert, the ancient summons to Shai-Hulud. The priests fled to their thopter and waited high overhead while a terrified Shiana, her worst fears realized, stood alone some 20 meters from the thumper. Two worms came. They were not the largest the priests had ever seen, no more than 30 meters long. One of them scooped up the thumper and silenced it. Together they rounded in parallel tracks and stopped, side by side, not 6 meters from Shiana. She stood submissive, fists clenched at her sides. This was what priests did. They fed you to Shaitan. In their hovering thopter, the two priests watched with fascination. Their lenses transmitted the scene to equally fascinated observers in the High Priest's quarters at Keen. All of them had seen similar events before. It was a standard punishment, a handy way to remove obstructionists from the populace or priesthood, or to pave the way for acquisition of a new concubine. Never before, though, had they seen a lone child as victim, and such a child. The worms of God crept forward slowly after their first stop. They became motionless once more when only about 3 meters from Shiana. Resigned to her fate, Shiana did not run. Soon, she thought, she would be with her parents and friends. As the worms remained motionless, anger replaced her terror. The bad priests had left her here. She could hear their thopter overhead. The hot spice smell from the worms filled the air around her. Abruptly, she raised her right hand and pointed up at the thopter.
"Go ahead and eat me. That's what they want."
The priests overhead could not hear her words, but the gesture was visible, and they could see that she was talking to the two worms of God. The finger pointing up at them did not bode well. The worms did not move. Shiana lowered her hand.
"You killed my mother and father and all my friends," she accused.
She took a step forward and shook a fist at them. The worms retreated, keeping their distance.
"If you don't want me, go back where you came from."
She waved them away toward the desert. Obediently, they backed farther and turned in unison. The priests in the thopter tracked them until they slipped beneath the sand more than a kilometer away. Only then did the priests return, fear and trepidation in them. They plucked the child of Shai-Hulud from the sand and returned her to Keen. The Bene Gesserit embassy at Keen had a full report by nightfall. Word was on its way to the chapter house by the following morning. It had happened at last. The trouble with some kinds of warfare, and be certain the tyrant knew this because it is implicit in his lesson, is that they destroy all moral decency in susceptible types. Warfare of these kinds will dump the destroyed survivors back into an innocent population that is incapable of even imagining what such returned soldiers might do. Teachings of the Golden Path, Bene Gesserit Archives. One of Miles Tegg's early memories was of sitting at dinner with his parents and his younger brother, Sabine. Tegg had been only 7 at the time, but the events lay indelibly in his memory. The dining room on Linnaeus, colourful with freshly cut flowers, the low light of the yellow sun diffused by antique shades, bright blue dinnerware and glistening silver graced the table. Acolyte servants stood ready at hand because his mother might be permanently detached on special duty, but her function as a Bene Gesserit teacher was not to be wasted. Janet Roxburgh Tegg, a large-boned woman who appeared cast for the part of Grande Dame, looked down her nose from one end of the table, watching that the dinner service not be impaired by the slightest misplacement. Loshid Tegg, Miles's father, always observed this with a faint air of amusement. He was a thin man with high forehead, a face so narrow his dark eyes appeared to bulge at the sides. His black hair was a perfect counterpoint for his wife's fairness. Above the subdued sounds at the table and the rich smell of spiced Edu soup, his mother instructed his father on how to deal with an importunate free trader. When she said, "Tlelaxu," She had Miles's entire attention. His education had just recently touched on the Bennett Lelaks. Even Sabine, who succumbed many years later to a poisoner on Romo, listened with as much of his four-year-old awareness as he could muster. Sabine hero-worshipped his brother. Anything that caught the attention of Miles was of interest to Sabine. Both boys listened intently.
"The man is fronting for the Tlelaxu," Lady Janet said. "I can hear it in his voice."
"I do not doubt your ability to detect such things, my dear," Loshiteg said. "But what am I to do? He has the proper tokens of credit, and he wishes to buy the order for the rice is unimportant at the moment. Never assume that what a face dancer appears to seek is actually what it seeks."
"I'm sure he's not a face dancer. He—"
"Loshi, I know you have learned this well at my instruction and can detect a face dancer. I agree that the free trader is not one of them. The face dancers remain on his ship. They know I am here."
"They know they could not fool you."
"Yes, but Tlelaxu's strategy is always woven within a web of strategies, any one of which may be the real strategy. They learned that from us."
"My dear, if we are dealing with Tlelaxu, and I do not question your judgment, then it immediately becomes a question of mélange."
Lady Janet nodded her head gently. Indeed, even Miles knew about the Tlelaxu connection with the spice. It was one of the things that fascinated him about the Tlelaxu. For every milligram of mélange produced on Rakkus, the Bennett Tlelax tanks produced long tons. Use of mélange had grown to fit the new supply, and even the Spacing Guild bent its knee before this power.
"But the rice," Loshi Teg ventured. "My dear husband, the Bennett Tlelax have no need of that much pongy rice in our sector. They require it for trade. We must find out who really needs the rice."
"You want me to delay," he said.
"Precisely. You are superb at what we now require. Don't give that free trader the chance to say yes or no. Someone trained by the face dancers will appreciate such subtlety."
"We lure the face dancers out of the ship while you initiate inquiries elsewhere."
Lady Janet smiled.
"You are lovely when you leap ahead of me that way."
A look of understanding passed between them.
"He cannot go to another supplier in this sector," Loshi Teg said.
"He will wish to avoid a go-no-go confrontation," Lady Janet said, patting the table. "Delay, delay, and more delay. You must draw the face dancers out of the ship."
"They will realize, of course."
"Yes, my dear, and it is dangerous. You must always meet on your own ground and with our own guards nearby."
Miles Teg recalled that his father had indeed drawn the face dancers out of their ship. His mother had taken Miles to the viewer where he watched the copper-walled room in which his father drove the bargain that won Chome's highest commendation and a rich bonus. The first face dancers Miles Teg ever saw. Two small men, as alike as twins, almost chinless round faces, pug noses, tiny mouths, black button eyes, and short-cropped white hair that stood up from their heads like the bristles on a brush. The two were dressed as the free trader had been, black tunics and trousers.
"Illusion, Miles," his mother said. "Illusion is their way. The fashioning of illusion to achieve real goals, that is how the Tlelaxu work."
"Like the magician at the winter show?"
Miles asked, his gaze intent on the viewer and its toy figure scene.
"Quite similar," his mother agreed.
She too watched the viewer as she spoke, but one arm went protectively around her son's shoulders.
"You are looking at evil, Miles. Study it carefully. The faces you see can be changed in an instant. They can grow taller, appear heavier. They could mimic your father so that only I would recognize the substitution."
Miles Tegg's mouth formed a soundless O. He stared at the viewer, listening to his father explain that the price of Chome's pongy rice once more had gone up alarmingly.
"And the most terrible thing of all," his mother said, "some of the newer face dancers can, by touching the flesh of a victim, absorb some of the victim's memories."
"They read minds?"
Miles looked up at his mother.
"Not exactly. We think they take a print of the memories, almost a holophoto process. They do not yet know that we are aware of this."
Miles understood. He was not to speak of this to anyone, not even to his father or his mother. She had taught him the Bene Gesserit way of secrecy. He watched the figures in the screen with care. At his father's words, the face dancers betrayed no emotion, but their eyes appeared to glitter more brightly.
"How did they get so evil?" Miles asked.
"They are communal beings, bred not to identify with any shape or face. The appearance they present now is for my benefit. They know I am watching. They have relaxed into their natural communal shape. Mark it closely."
Miles tipped his head to one side and studied the face dancers. They looked so bland and ineffectual.
"They have no sense of self," his mother said. "They have only the instinct to preserve their own lives unless ordered to die for their masters."
"Would they do that?"
"They have done it many times."
"Who are their masters?"
"Men who seldom leave the planets of the Bene Tleilax."
"Do they have children?"
"Not face dancers. They are mules, sterile. But their masters can breed. We have taken a few of them, but the offspring are strange. Few female births, and even then we cannot probe their other memories."
Miles frowned. He knew his mother was a Bene Gesserit. He knew the Reverend Mothers carried a marvellous reservoir of other memories going back through all the millennia of the sisterhood. He even knew something of the Bene Gesserit breeding design. Reverend Mothers chose particular men and had children by those men.
"What are the Tleilaxu women like?" Miles asked.
It was a perceptive question that sent a surge of pride through the Lady Janet. Yes, it was almost a certainty that she had a potential mentat here. The breeding mistresses had been right about the gene potential of Loshiteg.
"No one outside of their planets has ever reported seeing a Tleilaxu female," the Lady Janet said.
"Do they exist, or is it just the tanks?"
"They exist."
"Are any of the face dancers women?"
"At their own choice, they can be male or female."
"Observe them carefully. They know what your father is doing, and it angers them. Will they try to hurt my father?"
"They don't dare. We have taken precautions, and they know it. See how the one on the left works his jaws. That is one of their anger signs."
"You said they were communal beings."
"Like hive insects," Miles. "They have no self-image. Without a sense of self, they go beyond amorality. Nothing they say or do can be trusted."
Miles shuddered.
"We have never been able to detect an ethical code in them," the Lady Janet said. "They are flesh made into automata. Without self, they have nothing to esteem or even doubt. They are bred only to obey their masters."
"And they were told to come here and buy the rice?"
"Exactly. They were told to get it, and there's no other place in this sector where they can do that."
"They must buy it from father?"
"He's their only source. At this very moment, son, they are paying in melange, you see?"
Miles saw the orange-brown spice markers change hands, a tall stack of them which one of the face dancers removed from a case on the floor.
"The price is far, far higher than they ever anticipated," the Lady Janet said.
"This will be an easy trail to follow."
"Why?" "Someone will be bankrupted acquiring that shipment. We think we know who the buyer is. Whoever it is, we will learn of it. Then we will know what was really being traded here."
Lady Janet then began to point out the identifiable incongruities that betrayed a face dancer to trained eyes and ears. They were subtle signs, but Miles picked up on them immediately. His mother told him then that she thought he might become a mentat, perhaps even more. Shortly before his 13th birthday, Miles Tegg was sent away to advanced schooling at the Bene Gesserit stronghold on Lambadas, where his mother's assessment of him was confirmed. Word went back to her. "You have given us the warrior mentat we had hoped for." Tegg did not see this note until sorting through his mother's effects after her death. The words inscribed on a small sheet of Redulian crystal with the chapter house imprint below them filled him with an odd sense of displacement in time. His memory put him suddenly back on Lampadas, where the love-awe he had felt for his mother was deftly transferred to the sisterhood itself, as originally intended. He had come to understand this only during his later mentat training, but the understanding changed little. If anything, it bound him even more strongly to the Bene Gesserit. It confirmed that the sisterhood must be one of his strengths. He already knew that the Bene Gesserit sisterhood was one of the most powerful forces in his universe, equal at least to the Spacing Guild, superior to the Fish Speaker Council that had inherited the core of the old Atreides Empire, superior by far to Chome, and balanced, somehow, with the fabricators of Ix and with the Bene Tlelax. A small measure of the sisterhood's far-reaching authority could be deduced from the fact that they held this authority despite Tlelaxu tank-grown melange, which had broken the Rakian monopoly on the spice, just as Ixian navigation machines had broken the guild monopoly on space travel. Miles Tegg knew his history well by then. Guild navigators no longer were the only ones who could thread a ship through the folds of space, in this galaxy one instant, in a faraway galaxy the very next heartbeat. The school sisters held back little from him, revealing there for the first time the fact of his Atreides ancestry. That revelation was necessary because of the tests they gave him. They obviously were testing for prescience. Could he, like a guild navigator, detect fatal obstructions? He failed. They tried him next on no chambers and no ships. He was as blind to such devices as the rest of humankind. For this test, though, they fed him increased doses of the spice, and he sensed the awakening of his true self. "The mind at its beginning," a teaching sister called it, when he asked for an explanation of this odd sensation. For a time, the universe was magical as he looked at it through his new awareness. His awareness was a circle, then a globe. Arbitrary forms became transient. He fell into trance state without warning until the sisters taught him how to control this. They provided him with accounts of saints and mystics and forced him to draw a freehand circle with either hand, following the line with his awareness. By the end of the term, his awareness resumed its touch with conventional labels, but the memory of the magic never left him. He found that memory a source of strength at the most difficult moments. After accepting the assignment as weapons master to the Gola, Tegg found his magical memory increasingly with him. It was especially useful during his first interview with Shuang Yu at the keep on Gamu. They met in the Reverend Mother's study, a place of shiny metal walls and numerous instruments, most of them with the stamp of Ix on them. Even the chair in which she sat, the morning sun coming through a window behind her and making her face difficult to see, even that chair was one of the Ixian self-moulders. He was forced to sit in a chair dog, though he realized she must know he detested the use of any life form for such a demeaning task.
"You were chosen because you actually are a grandfatherly figure," Shuang Yu said.
The bright sunlight formed a corona around her hooded head. Deliberate.
"Your wisdom will earn the child's love and respect."
"There's no way I could be a father figure."
"According to Taraza, you have the precise characteristics she requires. I know of your honorable scars and their value to us."
This only reconfirmed his previous Mentat summation.
"They have been planning this for a long time. They have bred for it. I was bred for it. I am part of their larger plan."
All he said was,
"Taraza expects this child to become a redoubtable warrior when restored to his true self."
Shuang Yu merely stared at him for a moment, then,
"You must not answer any of his questions about Golas, should he encounter the subject. Do not even use the word until I give you permission. We will supply you with all of the Gola data your duties require."
Coldly parceling out his words for emphasis, Tegg said,
"Perhaps the Reverend Mother was not informed that I am well versed in the lore of Tlelaxu Golas. I have met Tlelaxu in battle."
"You think you know enough about the Idaho series?"
"The Idahos are reputed to have been brilliant military strategists," Tegg said.
"Then perhaps the great Bashar was not informed about the other characteristics of our Gola."
No doubt of the mockery in her voice. Something else as well, jealousy and great anger poorly concealed. Peg's mother had taught him ways of reading through her own masks, a forbidden teaching which he had always concealed. He feigned chagrin and shrugged. It was obvious, though, that Shuang Yu knew he was Taraz's basha. The lines had been drawn.
"At Bene Gesserit's behest," Shuang Yu said, "the Tleilaxu have made a significant alteration in the present Idaho series. His nerve muscle system has been modernized."
"Without changing the original persona?"
Teg fed the question to her blandly, wondering how far she would go in revelation.
"He is a Gola, not a clone."
"I see."
"Do you really? He requires the most careful Prana Bindu training at all stages."
"Taraz's orders exactly," Teg said, "and we will all obey those orders."
Shuang Yu leaned forward, not concealing her anger.
"You have been asked to train a Gola whose role in certain plans is most dangerous to us all. I don't think you even remotely understand what you will train."
What you will train, Teg thought, not whom. This Gola child would never be a whom for Shuang Yu or any of the others who opposed Taraza. Perhaps the Gola would not be a whom to anyone until restored to his original self, firmly seated in that original Duncan Idaho identity. Teg saw clearly now that Shuang Yu harbored more than hidden reservations about the Gola project. She was in active opposition, just as Taraza had warned. Shuang Yu was the enemy, and Taraza's orders had been explicit.
"You will protect that child against any threat."
10,000 years since Leto II began his metamorphosis from human into the sandworm of Rakis, and historians still argue over his motives. Was he driven by the desire for long life? He lived more than 10 times the normal span of 300 SY, but consider the price he paid. Was it the lure of power? He is called the tyrant for good reason, but what did power bring him that a human might want? Was he driven to save humankind from itself? We have only his own words about his golden path to answer this, and I cannot accept the self-serving records of Dar es Balat. Might there have been other gratifications which only his experiences would illuminate? Without better evidence, the question is moot. We are reduced to saying only that he did it. The physical fact alone is undeniable. The Metamorphosis of Leto II, 10,000th Anniversary Peroration by Gauss and Dowd. Once more, Waf knew he was on Lashkar. This time the stakes were as high as they could go. An honored Matre from the scattering demanded his presence. A Pawinda of Pawindas. Descendants of Tleilaxu from the scattering had told him all they could about these terrible women. "Far more terrible than reverend mothers of the Bene Gesserit," they said. "And more numerous," Waf reminded himself. He did not fully trust the returned Tleilaxu descendants either. Their accents were strange, their manners even stranger, and their observances of the rituals questionable. How could they be readmitted to the Great Kale? What possible rite of Jufran could cleanse them after all these centuries? They were no longer Malik brothers, and yet they were the only source of information that Tleilaxu possessed about these returning lost ones, and the revelations they had brought. Revelations that had been incorporated in the Duncan Idaho Golas. That was worth all of the risks of contamination by Pawinda evil. The meeting place with the honored Matres was the presumed neutrality of an Ixion no-ship that held a tight orbit around a mutually selected gas giant planet in a mined-out solar system of the old Imperium. The Prophet himself had drained the last of the wealth from this system. New face dancers walked as Ixions among the no-ship's crew, but Waf still sweated the first encounter. If these honored Matres were truly more terrible than the Bene Gesserit witches, would the exchange of face dancers for Ixion crewmen be detected? Selection of this meeting place and the arrangements had put a strain on the Tleilaxu. Was it secure? He reassured himself that he carried 2 sealed weapons never before seen off the Tleilaxu core planets. The weapons were the painstaking result of long effort by his artificers, two minuscule dart throwers concealed in his sleeves. He had trained with them for years until the flipping of the sleeves and the discharge of the poisoned darts was almost an instinctive reflex. The walls of the meeting room were properly copper-toned, evidence that they were shielded from Ixion spy devices, but what instruments might the people of the scattering have developed beyond the Ixion ken? Worf entered the room with a hesitant step. The honored Matre already was there, seated in a leather sling chair.
"You will call me what everyone else calls me," she greeted him. "Honored Matre."
He bowed as he had been warned to do.
"Honored Matre."
No hint of hidden powers in her voice. A low contralto with overtones that spoke of disdain for him. She looked like an aged athlete or acrobat, slowed and retired but still maintaining her muscle tone and some of her skills. Her face was tight skin over a skull with prominent cheekbones. The thin-lipped mouth produced a sense of arrogance when she spoke, as though every word were projected downward onto lesser folk.
"Well, come and sit down," she commanded, waving at a sling chair facing her.
Worf heard the hatch hiss closed behind him. He was alone with her. She was wearing a snooper. He could see the lead for it going into her left ear. His dart throwers had been sealed and washed against snoopers, then maintained at -340 degrees Kelvin in a radiation bath for 5 SY to make them proof against snoopers. Had it been enough? Gently he lowered himself into the indicated chair. Orange-tinted contact lenses covered the honored Matre's eyes, giving them a feral appearance. She was altogether daunting. And her clothing. Red leotards beneath a dark blue cape. The surface of the cape had been decorated with some pearly material to produce strange arabesques and dragon designs. She sat in the chair as though it were a throne, her claw-like hands resting easily on the arms. Worf glanced around the room. His people had inspected this place in company with Ixion maintenance workers and representatives of the honored Matre.
"We have done our best," he thought, and he tried to relax.
The honored Matre laughed. Worf stared at her with as calm an expression as he could muster.
"You are gauging me now," he accused. "You say to yourself that you have enormous resources to employ against me, subtle and gross instruments to carry out your commands."
"Do not take that tone with me."
The words were low and flat, but carried such a weight of venom that Worf almost recoiled. He stared at the stringy muscles of the woman's legs, that deep red leotard fabric which flowed over her skin as though it were organic to her. Their meeting time had been adjusted to bring them together at a mutually personal mid-morning, their waking hours having been balanced en route. Worf felt dislocated, though, and at a disadvantage. What if the stories of his informants were true? She must have weapons here. She smiled at him without humour.
"You are trying to intimidate me," Worf said. "And succeeding?"
Anger surged through Worf. He kept this from his voice.
"I have come at your invitation."
"I hope you did not come to engage in a confrontation that you would surely lose," she said.
"I have come to forge a bond between us," he said, and he wondered, what do they need from us? Surely they must need something.
"What bond can there be between us?" she asked. "Would you build an edifice on a disintegrating raft? Ha! Agreements can be broken, and often are."
"For what tokens do we bargain?" he asked.
"Bargain? I do not bargain. I am interested in this gola you made for the witches."
Her tone gave away nothing, but Worf's heartbeat quickened at her question. In one of his gola lifetimes, Worf had trained under a renegade mentat. The capabilities of a mentat were beyond him, and besides, reasoning required words. They had been forced to kill the Pawinda Mentat, but there had been some things of value in the experience. Worf allowed himself a small moue of distaste at the memory, but he recalled the things of value. Attack, and absorb the data that attack produces.
"You offer me nothing in exchange," he said, his voice loud.
"Recompense is at my discretion," she said.
Waff produced a scornful gaze.
"Do you play with me?"
She showed white teeth in a feral grin.
"You would not survive my play, nor want to. So I must be dependent upon your goodwill."
"Dependency."
The word curled from her mouth as though it produced a distasteful sensation.
"Why do you sell these golas to the witches and then kill the golas?"
Waff pressed his lips together and remained silent.
"You have somehow changed this gola while still making it possible for him to regain his original memories," she said.
"You know so much,"
Waff said. It was not quite a sneer, and, he hoped, revealed nothing. Spies. She had spies among the witches. Was there also a traitor in the Tlelaxu heartlands?
"There is a girl child on Rakis who figures in the plans of the witches,"
the honored Matre said.
"How do you know this?"
"The witches do not make a move without our knowing. You think of spies, but you cannot know how far our arms will reach."
Waff was dismayed. Could she read his mind? Was it something born of the scattering, a wild talent from out there, where the original human seed could not observe?
"How have you changed the Iskola?"
she demanded.
Voice.
Waff, armed against such devices by his Mentat teacher, almost blurted an answer. This honored Matre had some of the witch's powers. It had been so unexpected coming from her. You expected such things from a reverend mother, and were prepared. He was a moment recovering his balance. Waff steepled his hands in front of his chin.
"You have interesting resources," she said.
A gamin expression came over Waff's features. He knew how disarmingly elf-like he could look.
"Attack. We know how much you have learned from the Bene Gesserit," he said.
A look of rage swept over her face and was gone.
"They have taught us nothing."
Waff pitched his voice at a humorously appealing level, cajoling.
"Surely this is not bargaining."
"Isn't it?"
She actually appeared surprised. Waff lowered his hands.
"Come now, honored Matre. You are interested in this gola. You speak of things on Rakis. What do you take us for?"
"Very little. You'll become less valuable by the instant."
Waff sensed the coldest machine logic in her response. There was no smell of Mentat in it, but something more chilling. She is capable of killing me right here. Where were her weapons? Would she even require weapons? He did not like the look of those stringy muscles, the calluses on her hands, the hunter's gleam in her orange eyes. Could she possibly guess or even know about the dart throwers in his sleeves?
"We are confronted by a problem that cannot be resolved by logical means," she said.
Waff stared at her in shock. A Zensuni master might have said that. He had said it himself on more than one occasion.
"You have probably never considered such a possibility," she said.
It was as though her words dropped a mask away from her face. Waff suddenly saw through to the calculating person behind these postures. Did she take him for some pad-footed Seely, fit only for collecting slig shit? Bringing as much hesitant puzzlement into his voice as possible, he asked,
"How could such a problem be resolved?"
"The natural course of events will dispose of it," she said.
Waff continued to stare at her in simulated puzzlement. Her words did not smack of revelation. Still, the things implied. He said,
"Your words leave me floundering."
"Humankind has become infinite," she said. "That is the true gift of the scattering."
Waff fought to conceal the turmoil these words created.
"Infinite universes, infinite time, anything may happen," he said.
"Ach, you are a bright little mannequin," she said. "How does one allow for anything? It is not logical."
She sounded, Waff thought, like one of the ancient leaders of the Butlerian Jihad, which had tried to rid humankind of mechanical minds. This Honors Matre was strangely out of date.
"Our ancestors looked for an answer with computers," he ventured. "Let her try that."
"You already know that computers lack infinite storage capacity," she said.
Again her words disconcerted him. Could she actually read minds? Was this a form of mind printing? What the Tlelaxu did with face dancers and golas, others might do as well. He centered his awareness and concentrated on Ixians, on their evil machines, Pawinda machines. The Honored Matre swept her gaze around the room.
"Are we wrong to trust the Ixians?" she asked.
Waff held his breath.
"I don't think you fully trust them," she said. "Come, come, little man. I offer you my good will."
Belatedly, Waff began to suspect that she was trying to be friendly and candid with him. She certainly had put aside her earlier pose of angry superiority. Waff's informants from the Lost Ones said the Honored Matres made sexual decisions much in the manner of the Bene Gesserit. Was she trying to be seductive? But she clearly understood and had exposed the weakness of logic. It was very confusing.
"We are talking in circles," he said.
"Quite the contrary. Circles enclose, circles limit. Humankind no longer is limited by the space in which to grow."
There she went again. He spoke past a dry tongue.
"It is said that what you cannot control you must accept."
She leaned forward, the orange eyes intent on his face.
"Do you accept the possibility of a final disaster for the Bene Tlelaxu?
If that were the case, I would not be here."
"When logic fails, another tool must be used," Waff grinned.
"That sounds logical."
"Don't mock me! How dare you?"
Waff lifted his hands defensively and assumed a placating tone.
"What tool would the Honored Matre suggest?"
"Energy."
Her answer surprised him.
"Energy? In what form and how much?"
"You demand logical answers," she said.
With a feeling of sadness, Waff realized that she was not, after all, Zen Sunni. The Honored Matre only played word games on the fringes of non-logic, circling it, but her tool was logic.
"Rot at the core spreads outward," he said.
It was as though she had not heard his testing statement.
"There is untapped energy in the depths of any human we deign to touch," she said.
She extended a skeletal finger to within a few millimeters of his nose. Waff pulled back into his chair until she dropped her arm. He said,
"Is that not what the Bene Gesserit said before producing their Kwisatz Haderach?"
"They lost control of themselves and of him," she sneered.
Again, Waff thought, she employed logic in thinking of the non-logical. How much she had told him in these little lapses. He could glimpse the probable history of these Honored Matres. One of the natural Reverend Mothers from the Fremen of Rakis had gone out in the scattering. Diverse people had fled on the no-ships during and immediately after the famine times. A no-ship had seeded the wild witch and her concepts somewhere. That seed had returned in the form of this orange-eyed huntress. Once more she hurled a voice at him, demanding,
"What have you wrought with this gola?"
But this time Waff was prepared and shrugged it off. This Honored Matre would have to be deflected, or, if possible, slain. He had learned much from her, but there was no way of telling how much she had learned from him with her unguessed talents.
"They are sexual monsters," his informants had said. "They enslave men by the powers of sex." "How little you know the joys I could give you," she said.
Her voice coiled like a whip around him. How tempting. How seductive. Waff spoke defensively.
"Tell me why you..."
"I need tell you nothing."
"Then you did not come to bargain,"
he spoke sadly. The no-ships had indeed seeded those other universes with rot. Waff sensed the weight of necessity on his shoulders. What if he could not slay her?
"How dare you keep suggesting a bargain with an honored Matre?" she demanded. "Know you that we set the price?"
"I do not know your ways, honored Matre," Waff said, "but I sense in your words that I have offended."
"Apology accepted."
No apology intended. He stared at her blandly. Many things could be deduced from her performance. Out of his millennial experiences, Waff reviewed what he had learned here. This female from the scattering came to him for an essential piece of information. Therefore, she had no other source. He sensed desperation in her. Well masked, but definitely there. She needed confirmation or refutation of something she feared. How like a predatory bird she was, sitting there with her claw hands so lightly on the arms of her chair. Rot at the core spreads outward. He had said it, and she had not heard. Clearly, atomic humankind continued to explode on its scatterings of scatterings. The people represented by this honored Matre had not found a way to trace the no-ships. That was it, of course. She hunted the no-ships just as the witches of the Bene Gesserit did.
"You seek the way to nullify a no-ship's invisibility," he said.
The statement obviously rocked her. She had not expected this from the elf-like mannequin seated in front of her. He saw fear, then anger, then resolution pass across her features before she resumed her predatory mask. She knew, though. She knew he had seen.
"So that is what you do with your gola," she said.
"It is what the witches of the Bene Gesserit seek with him," Waff lied.
"I underestimated you," she said. "Did you make the same mistake with me?"
"I do not think so, honored Matre. The breeding scheme that produced you is quite obviously formidable. I think you could kick out a foot and kill me before I blinked an eye. The witches are not in the same league with you."
A smile of pleasure softened her features.
"Are the Tlelaxu to be our willing servants or compelled?"
He did not try to hide outrage.
"You offer us slavery? That is one of your options?"
He had her now. Arrogance was her weakness. Submissively he asked,
"What would you command me to do?"
"You will take back as your guests 2 younger honored Matres. They are to be bred with you and teach you our ways of ecstasy."
Waff inhaled and exhaled 2 slow breaths.
"Are you sterile?" she asked.
"Only our face dancers are mules."
She would already know that. It was common knowledge.
"You call yourself master," she said. "Yet you have not mastered yourself."
"More than you, honored Matre, bitch, and I call myself Mashik, a fact that may yet destroy you."
"The 2 honored Matres I sent with you will make an inspection of everything Tlelaxu and return to me with their report," she said.
He sighed as though in resignation.
"Are the 2 younger women comely?"
"Honored Matres," she corrected him.
"Is that the only name you use?"
"If they choose to give you names, that is their privilege, not yours."
She leaned sideways and rapped a bony knuckle against the floor, metal gleaming in her hand. She had a way of penetrating this room's shielding. The hatch opened, and 2 women dressed much like his honored Matre entered. Their dark capes carried less decoration, and both women were younger. Waff stared at them. Were they both? He tried not to show elation, but knew he failed. No matter. The older one would think he admired the beauty of these 2. By signs known only to the masters, he saw that one of the 2 newcomers was a new face dancer. A successful exchange had been made, and these scattered ones could not detect it. that Leilaxu had successfully passed a hurdle. Would the Bene Gesserit be as blind to these new Golas?
You are being sensibly agreeable about this, for which you will be rewarded, the old Honored Matre said.
I recognize your powers, Honored Matre, he said.
That was true. He bowed his head to conceal the resolution that he knew he could not keep from his eyes. She gestured to the newcomers.
These two will accompany you. Their slightest whim is your command. They will be treated with all honor and respect.
Of course, Honored Matre.
Keeping his head bowed, he lifted both arms as though in salutation and submission. A dart hissed from each sleeve. As he released the darts, Waff jerked himself sideways in his chair. The motion was not quite rapid enough. The old Honored Matre's right foot shot out, catching him in the left thigh and hurling him backward on his chair. It was the old Honored Matre's last living act. The dart from his left sleeve caught her in the back of her throat, entering through her opened mouth, a mouth left gaping in surprise. Narcotic poison cut off any outcry. The other dart hit the non-face dancer of the newcomers in the right eye. His face dancer accomplice cut off any warning shout by a blurred chop to the throat. Two bodies slumped in death. Painfully, Waff disentangled himself from the chair and righted it as he got to his feet. His thigh throbbed. A fraction of a meter more and she would have broken his thigh. He realized that her reaction had not been mediated by her central nervous system. As with some insects, attack could be initiated by the required muscle system. That development would have to be investigated. His face dancer accomplice was listening at the open hatch. She stepped aside to allow the entry of another face dancer in the guise of an Ixion guard. Waff massaged his injured thigh while his face dancers disrobed the dead women. The one who copied the Ixion put her head to that of the dead old Honored Matre. Things moved swiftly after that. Presently there was no Ixion guard, only a faithful copy of the old Honored Matre and a younger Honored Matre attendant. Another pseudo-Ixion entered and copied the younger Honored Matre. Soon there were only ashes where dead flesh had been. A new Honored Matre scooped the ashes into a bag and concealed it beneath her robe. Waff made a careful examination of the room. The consequences of discovery made him shudder. Such arrogance as he had seen here came from obviously awesome powers. Those powers must be probed. He detained the face dancer who had copied the old one.
You have printed her?
Yes, master. Her waking memories were still alive when I copied.
Transfer to her.
He gestured to the one who had been an Ixion guard. They touched foreheads for a few heartbeats, then parted.
It is done, said the older one.
How many other copies of these Honored Matres have we made?
4, master.
None of them detected?
None, master.
Those 4 must return to the heartland of these Honored Matres and learn all there is to know about them. One of those 4 must get back to us with what is learned.
That is impossible, master.
Impossible?
They have cut themselves off from their source.
This is their way, master. They are a new cell and have established themselves on Gamu. But surely we could—
Your pardon, master. The coordinates of their place in the scattering were contained only in a no-ship's workings and have been erased.
Their tracks are completely covered?
There was dismay in his voice.
Completely, master.
Disaster.
He was forced to rein in his thoughts from a sudden, frenzied darting.
They must not learn what we have done here, he muttered.
They will not learn from us, master.
What talents have they developed? What powers? Quickly?
They are what you would expect from a reverend mother of the Bene Gesserit, but without the melange memories.
You're sure?
There is no hint of it. As you know, master, we—
Yes, yes, I know.
He waved her to silence.
But the old one was so arrogant, so—
Your pardon, master, but time presses. These Honored Matres have perfected the pleasures of sex far beyond that developed by any others.
So it's true what our informant said.
They went back to the primitive tantric and developed their own ways of sexual stimulation, Master. Through this, they accept the worship of their followers.
Worship? He breathed the word.
Are they superior to the breeding mistresses of the sisterhood?
The honored Matres believe so, Master. Shall we demon?
No!
Waff dropped his elfin mask at this discovery and assumed the expression of a dominant master. The face dancers nodded their heads in submission. A look of glee came over Waff's face. The returned Tlilaxu of the scattering reported truthfully. By a simple mind print, he had confirmed this new weapon of his people.
What are your orders, Master? The old one asked.
Waff resumed his elfin mask.
We will explore these matters only when we have returned to the Tlilaxu core at Bandalong. Meanwhile, even a master does not give orders to an honored Matre. You are my masters, until we are free of prying eyes.
Of course, Master. Shall I now convey your orders to the others outside?
Yes, and these are my orders. This no-ship must never return to Gamu. It must vanish without a trace. No survivors.
It will be done, Master. Technology, in common with many other activities, tends toward avoidance of risks by investors. Uncertainty is ruled out if possible. Capital investment follows this rule since people generally prefer the predictable. Few recognize how destructive this can be, how it imposes severe limits on variability, and thus makes whole populations fatally vulnerable to the shocking ways our universe can throw the dice. Assessment of Ix, Bene Gesserit Archives. On the morning after that initial test in the desert, Shiana awoke in the priestly complex to find her bed surrounded by white-robed people.
Priests and priestesses? She's awake, a priestess said.
Fear gripped Shiana. She clutched the bed covers close to her chin while she stared out at those intent faces. Were they going to abandon her in the desert again? She had slept the sleep of exhaustion in the softest bed with the cleanest linen she had experienced in her 8 years, but she knew everything the priests did could have a double meaning. They were not to be trusted.
Did you sleep well?
It was the priestess who had spoken first. She was a grey-haired, older woman, her face framed in a white cowl with purple trim. Her old eyes were watery, but alert. Pale blue. The nose was an upturned stub above a narrow mouth and out-jutting chin.
Will you speak to us? The woman persisted. I am Kania, your night attendant. Remember, I helped you into your bed.
At least the tone of voice was reassuring. Shiana sat up and took a better look at these people. They were afraid. A desert child's nose could detect the telltale pheromones. To Shiana, it was a simple, straightforward observation.
That smell equals fear. You thought you would hurt me, she said. Why did you do that?
The people around her exchanged looks of consternation. Shiana's fear dissipated. She had sensed the new order of things, and yesterday's trial in the desert meant more change. She recalled how subservient the older woman, Kania, she had been almost grovelling the previous night. Shiana would learn in time that any person who lived through the decision to die evolved a new emotional balance. Fears were transitory. This new condition was interesting. Kania's voice trembled when she responded.
Truly, child of God, we did not intend harm.
Shiana straightened the bed covers on her lap.
My name is Shiana.
That was desert politeness. Kania already had produced a name.
Who are these others? They will be sent away if you don't want them, Shiana.
Kania indicated a florid-faced woman at her left, dressed in a robe similar to her own.
All except Alhosa, of course. She is your day attendant.
Alhosa curtsied at the introduction. Shiana stared up at a face puffy with water fat, heavy features in a nimbus of fluffy blonde hair. Shifting her attention abruptly, Shiana looked at the men in the group. They watched her with heavy-lidded intentness, some with looks of trembling suspicion. The fear smell was wrong.
Priests!
Send them away, Shiana waved a hand at the priests. They are haram!
It was the gutter word, the lowest term of all for that which was most evil. The priests recoiled in shock.
Be gone,
Kania commanded. There was no mistaking the look of malevolent glee on her face. Kania had not been included among the vile ones, but these priests clearly stood among those labelled as haram. They must have done something hideous for God to send a child priestess to chastise them. Kania could believe it of priests. They had seldom treated her the way she deserved. Like chastened bedogs, the priests bowed themselves backwards and left Shiana's chamber. Among those who went out into the hallway was a historian locutor named Dromind, a dark man with a busy mind that tended to fasten onto ideas like the beak of a carrion bird onto a morsel of meat. When the chamber door closed behind them, Dromind told his trembling companions that the name Shiana was a modern form of the ancient name Siona.
You all know Siona's place in the histories, he said. She served Shai-Hulud in his transformation from human shape into the divided god.
Styros, a wrinkled older priest with dark lips and pale glistening eyes, looked wonderingly at Dromind.
That is extremely curious, Styros said. The oral histories claim that Siona was instrumental in his translation from the one into the many. Shiana, do you think...
Let us not forget the Hadibenota translation of God's own holy words, another priest interrupted. Shai-Hulud referred many times to Siona.
Not always with favor, Styros reminded them. Remember her full name, Siona ibn Fuad al-Seyefa Atreides.
Atreides, another priest whispered.
We must study her with care, Dromind said.
A young acolyte messenger hurried up the hallway to the group and sought among them until he spied Styros.
Styros, the messenger said, you must clear this hallway immediately.
Why?
It was an indignant voice from the press of the rejected priests.
She is to be moved into the high priest's quarters, the messenger said.
By whose orders? Styros demanded.
High Priest Tuik himself says this, the messenger said. They have been listening.
He waved a hand vaguely toward the direction from which he had come. All of the group in the hall understood. Rooms could be shaped to send voices from them into other places. There were always listeners.
What have they heard?
Styros demanded. His old voice quavered.
She asked if her quarters were the best. They are about to move her, and she must not find any of you out here.
But what are we to do?
Styros asked.
Study her, Dromind said.
The hall was cleared immediately, and all of them began the process of studying Shiana. The pattern born here would print itself on all of their lives over the subsequent years. The routine that took shape around Shiana produced changes felt in the farthest reaches of the divided god's influence. Two words ignited the change. Study her. How naive she was, the priests thought. How curiously naive. But she could read, and she displayed an intense interest in the holy books she found in Tuek's quarters. Her quarters, now. All was propitiation from the highest to the lowest. Tuek moved into the quarters of his chief assistant, and the bumping process moved downward. Fabricators waited upon Shiana and measured her. The finest stillsuit was fashioned for her. She acquired new robes of priestly gold and white with purple trim. People began avoiding historian locutor Dromind. He took to buttonholing his fellows and expounding the history of the original Siona as though this said something important about the present bearer of the ancient name.
Siona was the mate of the holy Duncan Idaho,
Dromind reminded anyone who would listen.
Their descendants are everywhere.
Indeed, pardon me for not listening further, but I am really on an urgent errand.
At first, Tuek was more patient with Dromind. The history was interesting and its lessons obvious.
God has sent us a new Siona, Tuic said. All should be clear.
Dromond went away and returned with more tidbits from the past.
The accounts from Dar es Balat take on a new meaning now, Dromond told his high priest. Should we not make further tests and comparisons of this child?
Dromond had braced the high priest immediately after breakfast. The remains of Tuic's meal still occupied the serving table on the balcony. Through the open window, they could hear stirrings overhead in Shiana's quarters. Tuic put a cautioning finger to his lips and spoke in a hushed voice.
The holy child goes on her own choice to the desert.
He went to a wall map and pointed to an area southwest of Keen.
Apparently, this is an area that interests her. Or, I should say, calls her.
I am told she makes frequent use of dictionaries, Dromond said. Surely that cannot be a...
She is testing us, Tuic said. Do not be fooled.
But Lord Tuic, she asks the most childish questions of Kainia and Alhosa.
Do you question my judgment, Dromond?
Belatedly, Dromond realized he had overstepped the proper bounds. He fell silent, but his expression said many more words were compressed within him.
God has sent her to weed out some evil that has crept into the ranks of the anointed, Tuic said. Go, pray, and ask yourself if that evil has lodged itself within you.
When Dromond had gone, Tuic summoned a trusted aide.
Where is the holy child?
She has gone out into the desert, Lord, to commune with her father.
To the southwest?
Yes, Lord.
Dromond must be taken far out to the east and left on the sand. Plant several thumpers to make sure he never returns.
Dromond, Lord?
Dromond.
Even after Dromond was translated into the mouth of God, the priests continued to follow his original injunction. They studied Shiana. Shiana also studied. Gradually, so gradually that she could not identify the point of transition, she recognized her great power over those around her. At first it was a game, a continual children's day with adults jumping to obey each childish whim, but it appeared that no whim was too difficult. Did she require a rare fruit for her table? The fruit was served to her on a golden dish. Did she glimpse a child far below on the teeming streets and require that child as a playmate? That child was hustled up to Shiana's temple quarters. When fear and shock passed, the child might even join in some game, which the priests and priestesses observed intently. Innocent skipping about on the rooftop garden, giggling whispers, all were subjected to intense analysis. Shiana found the awe of such children a burden. She seldom called the same child back to her, preferring to learn new things from new playmates. The priests achieved no consensus about the innocence of such encounters. The playmates were put through fearful interrogation, until Shiana discovered this and raged at her guardians. Inevitably, word of Shiana spread through Rakis and off-planet. The sisterhood's reports accumulated. The years passed in a kind of sublimely autocratic routine, feeding Shiana's curiosity. It was a curiosity that appeared to have no limits. None of those among the immediate attendants thought of this as education, Shiana teaching the priests of Rakis and they teaching her. The Bene Gesserit, however, observed this aspect of Shiana's life at once and watched it closely.
She is in good hands. Leave her there until she is ready for us, Terrasa ordered. Keep a defense force on constant alert and see that I get regular reports.
Not once did Shiana reveal her true origins, nor what Shaitan had done to her family and neighbors. That was a private thing between Shaitan and herself. She thought of her silence as payment for having been spared. Some things paled for Shiana. She made fewer trips into the desert. Curiosity continued, but it became obvious that an explanation of Shaitan's behavior toward her might not be found on the open sand. And although she knew there were embassies of other powers on Rakis, the Bene Gesserit spies among her attendants made sure that Shiana did not express too much interest in the sisterhood. soothing answers to dampen such interest were provided and meted out to Shiana as required. The message from Taraza to her observers on Rakis was direct and pointed. The generations of preparation have become the years of refinement. We will move only at the proper moment. There is no longer any doubt that this child is the one. In my estimation, more misery has been created by reformers than by any other force in human history. Show me someone who says, "Something must be done," and I will show you a head full of vicious intentions that have no other outlet. What we must strive for always is to find the natural flow and go with it. The Reverend Mother Taraza, Conversational Record BG File GSXXMAT9. The overcast sky lifted as the son of Gamur climbed, picking up the scents of grass and surrounding forest extracted and condensed by the morning dampness. Duncan Idaho stood at a forbidden window inhaling the smells. This morning Patrin had told him,
"You are 15 years of age. You must consider yourself a young man. You no longer are a child."
"Is it my birthday?"
They were in Duncan's sleeping chamber, where Patrin had just aroused him with a glass of citrus juice.
"I do not know your birthday."
"Do Golas have birthdays?"
Patrin remained silent. It was forbidden to speak of Golas with the Gola.
"Shuang Yu says you can't answer that question," Duncan said.
Patrin spoke with obvious embarrassment.
"The Basha wishes me to tell you that your training class will be delayed this morning. He wishes you to do the leg and knee exercises until you are called."
"I did those yesterday."
"I merely convey the Basha's orders."
Patrin took the empty glass and left Duncan alone. Duncan dressed quickly. They would expect him for breakfast in the commissary. Damn them! He did not need their breakfast. What was the Basha doing? Why couldn't he start the classes on time? Leg and knee exercises. That was just make work because Teg had some rather unexpected duty. Angrily, Duncan took a forbidden route to a forbidden window.
Let the damned guards be punished.
He found the odours coming through the open window evocative, but could not place the memories that lurked at the edges of his awareness. He knew there were memories. Duncan found this frightening but magnetic, like walking along the edge of a cliff, or openly confronting Shuang Yu with his defiance. He had never walked along the edge of a cliff, nor openly confronted Shuang Yu with defiance, but he could imagine such things. Just seeing a film book holophoto of a cliff-edge path was enough to make his stomach tighten. As for Shuang Yu, he often imagined angry disobedience and suffered the same physical reaction.
"Someone else is in my mind," he thought.